With the inauguration of the Pritzker administration, Democrats now have a historic majority in Springfield. What does that mean for Republicans in Illinois?
Governor Rauner was elected 4 years ago with the hope and the idea that he was going to shake things up here. And the governor, unfortunately, never really wanted to go by the idea that it takes 60 and 30 to get something done in this building.
That's former Illinois Manufacturing Association President Greg Bays speaking to WCIA last year. Today, now that there's no longer a Republican governor, what does the future of the Illinois GOP look like? Later, a new study shows the cost of local government increases in areas without newspapers. Former journalist and creator of The Wire, David Simon, inspired researchers to look at the issue.
This is going to be one of the great times to be a corrupt politician. I really envy them. I really do.
Plus, SNAP benefits are arriving weeks early due to the government shutdown. How will that affect both recipients and retailers? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The federal government has been partially shut down for 25 days. Today, we're going to talk about how SNAP benefits in Illinois are being affected by the gridlock in Washington. Closer to home, yesterday in Springfield, Democrat J.B. Pritzker was officially sworn in as our 43rd governor. In his inaugural speech, he touched on everything from raising the minimum wage to legalizing recreational marijuana to promising a balanced budget. Former Governor Bruce Rauner sat behind the new governor as he addressed the crowded Bank of Springfield Center. And throughout the speech, Pritzker didn't hesitate to go after the previous administration. Later this hour, we're going to be talking about the future of the GOP in Illinois, especially the Republican Party's identity throughout the state. But first, we've got WBEZ Politics reporter Dave McKinney with us from Chicago. Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning, Nyla.
What stood out to you yesterday from J.B. Pritzker's inauguration speech, Dave?
Well, I mean, it was a, you know, very uplifting kind of speech filled with, you know, threads of hope and things like that. I mean, that's sort of a conventional speech from, you know, a politician taking office. And, you know, you heard it from in the past. You've heard these kinds of speeches from, you know, Bruce Rauner, Pat Quinn, Rod Blagojevich, and going back. I mean, I think, you know, what makes this speech a little bit different is that it's being delivered in an environment where I think people on both sides of the aisle are genuinely happy to see a new governor coming in. I mean, you know, love him or hate him. I mean, the thing about Bruce Rauner is that, you know, he was a very divisive, polarizing figure in Springfield, didn't get a lot done there. And I think there is hope under Pritzker that there will, you know, at least be progress in some things that both parties care about.
I'm going to play a moment from that to the point of polarization and the budget, a little bit of that speech.
I won't balance the budget on the backs of the starving, the sick, and the suffering. And I won't hollow out the functions of government to achieve an ideological agenda. I won't make government the enemy and government employees the scapegoats.
Dave, it's hard to tell from that audio there, but being in that room yesterday, I think those were the biggest applause lines of his speech. That's when people were standing up and cheering, and you maybe don't get that from listening to that audio there, but I can tell you that's what it was like yesterday. I want to ask you about what you think, as we're going forward with this administration, what you think Pritzker highlighted yesterday that we're going to start seeing some action on.
Well, I mean, he made clear, you know, he's got an ambitious agenda that you know, involves, I mean, you know, the mundane task of passing a budget. I mean, he highlighted that in his speech, you know, and that drew an applause line. I mean, it used to be that was the sort of
the governor's job to pass
the
budget.
Sort of the governor's job, and we expect that every year. And of course, you know, going 2 years without one under the Rauner administration was very difficult for the state. So, I mean, you know, he talks about a budget. He talks about recreational marijuana, making that legalized. Talks about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which would be the highest in the nation. He talks about a capital construction program, which, you know, Illinois hasn't had since 2009. So, I mean, you know, there's a long lineup of things that he wants to do, and honestly some pent-up demand, I think, among Democrats especially, to try to get some things done that they haven't been able to move under 4 years of Republican control of the governor's mansion.
We've been asking our listeners to send in questions about the new administration, and I'm sorry, we promised that we were going to do it yesterday, and it got a little crazy with the program schedule, and we weren't able to get to them. But we are going to start answering them today, and keep tuning in, because we'll continue to answer these questions over the next couple of weeks. Dave, I wanted to ask you, to that point about the capital budget, Matthew Slade lives in Durand. It's about 20 minutes northwest of Rockford. He's actually a village trustee there, and he wanted to know about that point of infrastructure spending, in particular the idea of a commuter rail to Rockford. How likely are we to see more infrastructure spending in things like a commuter rail system?
Well, I mean, you know, the thing about commuter rail systems is that those, rail systems, you know, big ambitious projects like that are sort of taken in a piecemeal basis because they're so expensive. But you know, Illinois, as I mentioned, has gone almost 10 years since, there was a big infrastructure plan. I mean, under Pat Quinn in his first year as governor in 2009, he signed a $31 billion construction program. And before that, you had to go all the way back, I believe, to 1999 under George Ryan for the previous one. So, I mean, these things come along, every 10 years or so. Anybody who's driven on our highways or bridges or school buildings, I mean, you just get a sense that everything kind of needs to be fixed up a little bit in Illinois. And that's what that's going to aim to do.
One other listener question I wanted to get to. Bevan Champagne was asking us about marijuana legalization. We got a couple of questions about that. But she said that it seems like this is going to happen. Several other states have already gone through this process. What kind of effort will Governor Pritzker's office or other entities pursue prior to legalization? She was saying there's lots of lessons that can be gleaned from the experience of other states.
Yeah, I mean, I would say for starters, I mean, you know, the governor has said on the campaign trail that legalizing marijuana for recreational use in Illinois could generate between $500 million and $700 million a year in tax revenues. I mean, I think based on other states' experiences, as that caller alluded to, you know, you might want to tamp down those expectations because, states like Colorado, it along with Washington legalized recreational marijuana in 2012. I mean, their experience there, they've raised $266 million in tax revenues as of 2018.
And they were the first, so they had a lot of people pouring resources and businesses into that.
That's right. And in Washington State, I mean, you know, the tax revenues there they're somewhere north of $300 million, and there's a 37% tax rate there. So it's, you know, they tax it quite highly, but you know, we're not seeing experiences in other states where, you know, it's going to come in and be an end-all be-all to our budgetary problems.
You can keep those questions coming if you go to askthe21st.org. That's askthe21st.org. Thanks to Matthew and to Bev for submitting some questions. And we're going to get to more of them and more in-depth ones later on as well. I just wanted to answer a couple quickly. Dave, I want to ask you last but certainly not least in the area of Arena of Politics. Your new podcast debuts on Friday. It's called Public Official A. I think political nerds in Illinois will recognize that particular aspect of Illinois political history. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, that phrase was contained in an obscure legal document about a decade ago, or actually farther back than that, and it referred to Rod Blagojevich. And so what we've attempted to do, this is in November, was the 10-year anniversary of his arrest. But more importantly, we're not aiming to do sort of a, you know, what we in the journalism industry call a clip job, where we're just sort of rehashing things. I mean, having that 10 years of perspective, kind of, you know, people reflecting back on it, everybody from, you know, Mrs. Blagojevich to the FBI agents that arrested Blagojevich to, you know, some of the people that were involved in the investigation, both, you know, former friends of the governor's and FBI agents. I mean, these, you know, the perspective you get from that time is quite telling. And what makes it current, of course, is that, you know, beginning last summer and even through December, we had hints from Donald Trump in the White House that you know, he might consider commuting Rod Blagojevich's sentence. So that makes this thing a very current story. And so we, you know, at its core is whether or not Rod Blagojevich, who was sentenced to 14 years in prison for what he did, you know, basically built around selling, you know, trying to sell the U.S. Senate seat vacated by Barack Obama, whether that sentence of 14 years was too harsh. He's entering year 7 of it. And, you know, that's really kind of the core of this. Has he spent enough time or not?
That's Dave McKinney, WBEZ politics reporter. And as we're talking about, host of this new podcast, it debuts on Friday. So wherever you get your podcast, look out for Public Official A to dive into that. Dave, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Nolan. Thanks for the plug.
So Dave McKinney, former newspaper reporter like myself, and the idea of public corruption, that's what we're going to be talking about next, because we hear about the economic problems of running newspapers all the time. And when we think about local journalists, Those of us who I mentioned who are in the industry often bemoan newsroom cuts, and we tend to think they're bad, right? We think about the idea of, does this lead to more public corruption? What is the cost really to a community? Well, it turns out the decline in local journalism can affect taxpayers, and that's according to new research from UIC and Notre Dame. Some researchers there recently found that the cost of local government increases in communities where a newspaper has recently closed. Dermot Murphy is an assistant professor of finance at UIC. He worked on this research. He's on the line with us now. Hi, Dermot. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me on the program.
Chris Kiergaard's also with us, an associate editor for the Peoria Journal-Star, to give us a little bit of a local newspaper perspective. Hey, Chris, welcome back.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Dermot, I thought we should start with actually playing a clip of another former newspaper journalist. There's a lot of us around there. This is David Simon, very famous for The Wire, which he created. And this clip made the rounds after it was featured on an episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
The day I run into a Huffington Post reporter at a Baltimore zoning board hearing is the day that I will be confident that we've actually reached some sort of equilibrium. You know, there's no glory in that kind of journalism, but that is the bedrock of what keeps, you know, the next 10 or 15 years in this country are going to be a halcyon era for state and local political corruption. It is going to be one of the great times to be a corrupt politician, right? I really envy them. I really do.
Dermot, I wonder how that inspired the research that you and a couple of other folks did recently on this.
You know, we very much agree with that quote, and that was certainly part of the inspiration for our research paper. And, you know, if you look at the findings, you'll see that they're very much in line with what David Simon was saying. I mean, what we're finding is that following a newspaper closure, we see that government inefficiencies are more likely in the long run, and corruption is a part of those inefficiencies. And because there is more inefficiencies at the local government level, lenders get a little more nervous about lending to a local government, so interest rates go up. That ultimately costs taxpayers money.
And so that's what we're really looking at here is the cost of borrowing. Is that what you all did to kind of figure out, to quantify this, to put a dollar figure to this?
Yeah, exactly. So municipalities need to raise money all the time to fund public infrastructure projects, such as schools, hospitals, and roadways. And so what we find is that after a newspaper closure, the interest rate that these local governments have to pay on their loans actually goes up because the lenders are more nervous about lending to these local governments because of the higher incidences of corruption and inefficiencies, basically. Money's being wasted, you could say.
So I know you guys looked at this all over the country. Do you have an actual dollar figure? Is there a number we can use to kind of wrap our heads around how much this might be costing taxpayers?
Oh, certainly. I mean, in our scientific terms, first of all, the cost goes up by about 0.1 percentage points, i.e. 10 basis points. But if you translate that to a dollar figure, that costs the average municipality about $650,000 extra in interest per loan. And we consider that a lower bound estimate because that's only one loan, and local governments have to take out many loans over time to fund different public infrastructure projects. So these costs can really add up.
So just to be clear, more than $500,000 more in interest on just one loan is what you guys are looking at.
On just one loan, yeah. And, you know, we estimate this as $650,000, but even on a per loan basis, we think that this cost could go up if the corruption problem continues to worsen because of the lack of coverage by local newspapers.
And Dermot, when we're talking about this, is this for newspapers that have shut or also when we're thinking about newspapers that have downsized as well?
We use both in our sample, actually. So we do have plenty of newspapers that do close down, but we also have newspapers that significantly downsize. And that is a pretty serious problem right now, even. I mean, the Denver Post underwent a series of cuts recently, and many other newspapers have as well. So we decided to include both in the sample, and we see that the local government problem is there for both newspapers that close and ones that downsize.
That's Dermot Murphy. He teaches in the Department of Finance at UIC, and we're talking about some research that he and some colleagues at Notre Dame did. Chris Kiergaard is also with us with the Peoria Journal-Star. Chris, I wanted to ask you to come on because to share a little bit about your firsthand experience with newsroom layoffs and downsizing. Can you share your story?
I can, yes. Late last year, at the start of September, the Journal-Star underwent some staffing reductions, as we and most other papers our size across America have. And I was one of the employees at the time who had been selected for reduction based on a seniority basis. And it was only a couple of weeks later that our executive editor, our publisher, recognized the concern that it was in not having somebody in a position doing accountability journalism, focusing on politics, on government, on some of those non-sexy issues like zoning meetings or outlying communities and what they were looking at or doing, and recognized the need to create a position that focused on those issues, on in-depth reporting, on accountability reporting. And I was fortunate enough to be one of those few journalists across the country who were only temporarily out of work, but were able to come back, in my case, to the same institution and continue doing similar work, more in-depth work on focusing on local governments. And to take this beyond my experience into another, we recently had another of our reporters who have left for a different position. It was a voluntary departure, but as he left, we looked at ourselves, those of us who were here, and recognized the absolute need for having somebody who was doing investigative work. And we're hoping to hire, we're advertising right now for applicants for a position with the understanding that it is doing that same kind of investigative work.
Investigative work, particularly when it comes to government reporting as well, Chris, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Chris,
replaces the guy who's former police, got two former police chiefs gone.
Wow. Okay, well, we have to take a break. If you can stick around with us, Chris and Dermot, there's a couple more questions I wanted to ask you. Dermot, about your research. Chris, a little bit more about local journalism when it comes to the Peoria Journal-Star. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about the decline of local newspapers, and it's not just a loss of information, knowledge, or civic pride when local newspapers shut or downsize. We're talking about the cost to taxpayers and some new research. Dermot Murphy is an assistant professor of finance at UIC. He and some colleagues at UIC in Notre Dame have looked at this, and we've been talking about the increased cost of borrowing that happens in municipalities that have smaller local newspapers or where newspapers have been shot. Chris, I wonder what the size of the Peoria Journal-Star is now compared to when you first started?
Well, like many other newspapers, it's declined by more than half since we started. We've got about 25 folks or thereabouts in the newsroom between news, sports, photography, editing, design, all of those things. And we forced ourselves to become a little more selective on what we're doing, but with an eye more toward what are the things that are really going to matter to people at the end of the day in being able to make intelligent decisions on what they're going to do with their vote, with their money, where they live, and be better citizens because of that. And it's forced us to realize a little more about that than maybe we thought about beforehand.
Dermot, when it comes to Illinois, how many local papers did you look at across Illinois that have gotten smaller or gone away entirely?
I think we find that there were around 9 or 10 newspapers in Illinois that closed or downsized in some form during our sample period. So we see this as a fairly serious problem all across the United States, including Illinois.
And so that's for a period from 1996 to 2015, 9 newspapers that have either closed or downsized to maybe 4 days a week or maybe merged with other papers. Dermot, I just wanted to ask you, as someone who I imagine is a news consumer, but now this is another interesting angle of this, how much taxpayers have to pay, how that's changed how you think about when you see these headlines or stories about the decline of local newspapers or local journalism.
I mean, when I see these stories about the decline of local journalism, I think to myself that this is going to be ultimately costly for the country. I mean, there have been studies that have shown that there are political costs to not having newspaper coverage. You know, voters become less engaged, and they know a lot less about their local politicians and so on. But from a finance angle, we find that that the closure of local newspapers is ultimately costing taxpayers money. I mean, we already talked about how it's costly to local governments, but this does get passed on to the local taxpayer. And I think our estimates show that this costs the average local taxpayer almost $100 per year because of the extra cost to local government.
That's Dermot Murphy. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Finance at UIC. We'll tweet out this research if you're interested in reading more about it. And I want to thank Chris Kjærgaard for being with us as well, an associate editor with the Peoria Journal Star. Dermot, Chris, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thank you.
As of yesterday, all of the winners of last fall's midterm elections have officially taken power in Illinois. Republican Bruce Rauner is out. Democrat J.B. Pritzker is in, along with a lot of Democrats in the General Assembly now with a supermajority. Democrats got that by winning in part in traditionally Republican suburbs of Chicago. But what about in the rest of the state? And where does the Illinois GOP go from here? Ted McClellan has been writing about this for Chicago Magazine. Also joining us to talk about this issue is Pat Brady, former chairman of the Illinois Republican Party. Ted, Pat, both of you, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, thanks for
glad to be here.
Pat, I wonder if I could start with you just in terms of your reaction to the several different points that Governor Pritzker laid out from his agenda yesterday. And he painted a very pointed contrast to his predecessor who was sitting up there with him. I wonder what moments stuck out with you.
Well, I thought it was a I'm sorry. Was that directed to me? Did it jump in?
To Pat, yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. No problem. Overall, very good. I thought it was a very, for the most part, very positive speech. He repeated a lot of the themes that he had stated during the campaign. And we kind of took one kind of veiled shot at the governor who was sitting there. And overall, positive. I think probably in politics right now, given in Illinois, at least, we've had almost 20 years of fighting and civil war within the parties and against one another, but I think voters and the people in the state are ready for a positive message. That being said, some of that agenda, I'm not sure if it's realistic, given that we're a state teetering on the verge of bankruptcy, although a state can't technically go bankrupt. But we have a lot of structural issues we need to deal with first before we can hand out the list of things that I think the governor put in his speech yesterday.
So, Pat, Governor Pritzker hadn't even finished speaking when we got statements from the ceremony hadn't finished. I think he'd finished speaking, but perhaps the ceremony wasn't even over before we got a response from the Illinois Republican Party Chairman Tim Snyder. And he said that it's clear Governor Pritzker's agenda will, quote, be the same as the agenda that has dragged our state down for a decade. Borrow, tax, spend, repeat. I wonder, to that point, how you think where you think Republicans stand now as the party that has often said this over and over again, but now is in limited, even more smaller role than they were previously in Illinois government.
Yeah, I don't think that Tim Snyder's statement, and I understand his role because he needs to motivate the base of the party, but I don't think that that statement's reflective of the attitude that the leaders in Springfield, either Jim Durkin in the House or Bill Brady in the Senate, are taking towards Governor Pritzker. I think that they all see on both sides of the aisle, including Speaker Madigan, John Cullerton, President Cullerton, that there is a lane in the middle of the state to get something done. And we're at a crisis stage. We lost 45,000 citizens last year. Those are an overwhelming majority of taxpayers. We really are at a crisis stage. I think people recognize that we need to, in a bipartisan way, address a lot of these structural issues that need to be fixed in this state.
To that point of the base, Ted, you have been reporting about what the Republican base looks like in Illinois now, how that's shifted across time. And I put there was something that kind of jumped out from your reporting, Ted. You pointed out that J.B. Pritzker won just 15 of the 102 counties in Illinois to win the election.
Yeah, and Pat Quinn won just 4 when he won in 2010. So, you know, I was just looking at a map of the 1992 presidential election, and Bill Clinton won Cook County, and then he won basically everything south of I-72, except maybe Effingham. And George H.W. Bush won the collar counties. And basically what's happened is, I mean, and this follows national trends, you know, rural voters with southern affiliations have moved to the Republican Party, so you'll see counties like I went to the Old King Coal Festival in Franklin County, a coal mining festival. And Dave Severin, who's a state representative down there, he got up and he just recently beat a Democrat. He got up and he began his speech by saying, "God, guns, and coal." So that's what they stand for in Southern Illinois. So Southern Illinois has become Republican. But at the same time, the collar counties, which used to be the Republican stronghold, have become Democratic. And trading Southern Illinois for the collar counties has turned out to be a much better deal for the Democrats than for the Republicans.
Pat, I wonder how you see increased Democratic representation in the Chicago suburbs, how that you think will affect state government throughout Illinois as well as the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think it's a little more complicated than just that. And I do agree, downstate has been trending Republican. But in the collars in DuPage and in Lake, I wouldn't say it's Democratic. They had a good year, and they did pick up some seats they didn't even think they'd win. But the reality is, and I live in the western suburbs, the issues that are important to the voters in those areas are fiscal issues. They're issues of the biggest is property taxes and income taxes and infrastructure. So things that I think, again, appeal to that middle lane, that if the Democrats go lurch too far to the left, don't address the property tax issue, spend too much money, run up more deficits and debt, I think in the next election, they're going to have problems. And Speaker Madigan's the smartest politician in the state. He understands that if he wants to keep those seats he picked up in traditionally Republican areas, he can't go too far to the left on tax and spend. And they're going to really have to have a productive session and prove to these people in these areas that are elected to vote for Democrats, the Democrats can actually solve the problems.
We're speaking with Pat Brady, longtime Illinois Republican, former chair of the Illinois GOP, and Ted McClelland, a Chicago-based journalist. He's been writing about this issue for Chicago Magazine. We'll tweet out Ted's story. I wanted to play for you guys actually a clip from a conversation that Brian Mackey and I had yesterday with Representative Greg Harris from Chicago. He's the new House Majority Leader. We talked to him at Governor Pritzker's inauguration yesterday, and we actually asked him about the challenges of having lots of voters with different interests in the Democratic Party.
Well, I think the really good thing there this year is that across the state, people decided voting for Democrats was the right thing to do, and we have more new Democrats elected to the House this year than any time in recent memory. But, you know, every person is not the same. They all come from different districts. They come from different parts of the state. They come with different concerns. So, yeah, when you have a huge number of members, being sure that every viewpoint is heard and that, you know, every region of the state's needs are taken care of, it is a big challenge. But that's a good thing. So it means there's a lot of voices. There will be a lot of debate. You know, there are some members who are, you know, more to the moderate side than others. Some members who are more, you know, liberal than others. You've got Chicago, suburban, central Illinois, you know, southern. A lot of different things to balance.
So that's Representative Greg Harris yesterday. Pat, I wonder, as you listen to Representative Harris talking about the Democratic Party, it's kind of what you said about thinking about the whole idea of suburban Chicago, how many of those voted for Democrats, I mean, for Democrats this time around. But this whole issue of property taxes, this isn't it's not a single party issue here. Right. So I wonder how you see this balance going forward for the GOP when you're thinking about moderate versus conservative wings of the party.
Yeah, let me take a step to say, picking Greg Harris for that position, Speaker Madigan couldn't have made a better pick. He's
one of the hardest working people I've ever met in politics, a smart guy. And you heard his answer. He understands that you have to have a big tent if you're going to have a successful party, which the Democrats have done a good job of doing the last couple of years. So my hat's off to him and good luck to him. But to answer your conservative, less conservative question about the Republican Party, we are the conservative party. But what I think we need to get back to, particularly in areas where we lost, we need to come up with some kind of suburban agenda and prove to voters that Republicans can govern and govern in a good way and address the issues that are important to the voters, to the population centers of this state. And with the discussion we're talking about upstate, downstate, I think that is a lot of influence anyway. A lot of that's dictated by the governor. But the reality is for Republicans, we lost seats in heavily populated areas because we didn't present the faces or an agenda of a party that can actually prove to people that we can govern, govern effectively.
And Ted, this whole idea of who's downstate and who's in office from downstate, what does that look like now when we're thinking about our statewide office holders?
Well, you know, the Southern Illinois used to be a stronghold of the Democratic Party. I think, you know, that was in the days when, among other things, unions were much stronger than they are now.
Are you thinking of kind of like the Paul Simon generation? Is that what we're talking about?
Sure.
Okay, that era.
Paul Simon, Alan Dixon, Paul Powell. So these were some of the most prominent politicians in Illinois. And people like, you know, Mayor Daley, when he was putting together the statewide ticket, he always wanted a downstater on there to make sure he got the downstate vote. But the center of gravity of Illinois politics is almost entirely now shifted to the Chicago area. You have this alliance now between the city and the suburbs, and then an alliance between Central Illinois and Southern Illinois. And so downstate is really getting shut out of power. And I had a quote in one of my stories from a pollster named Brian Stryker, and he talked about how sort of urban issues are going to be more prominent now at the expense of rural issues. For example, gun rights. I mean, even when Democrats were elected from Southern Illinois, they were, for the most part, in favor of gun rights. They were in favor of coal. And those just are not going to have a constituency in the majority Democratic caucus now.
Pat, I wonder if you could respond to that a little bit in terms of just thinking about Republican voters throughout the state and trying to have a party that can meet the needs of both suburban Republicans in Chicago as well as Republicans in the corners of the state.
Yeah, and I've been saying this for years, for both parties to be successful in the state. And I've lived and worked in every corner of the state, so I'm very familiar with the political makeup of this state. And I've always believed it's much more of a centrist state than it is either to the right or to the left politically. So for either party, particularly the Republicans, which is to answer your question, we need to, as a party, focus on the issues, the fiscal issues, the issues I talked about before, property taxes, economic growth, jobs. We want the state to be a place where our kids can return to. We have to deal with the net outflow of people leaving the state. Those are the issues that I think are long-term important to the viability of the state at this point, and those are the issues I think Republicans need to focus on. When we get wrapped up in the other issues, we tend to not do very well. We got to realize what state we live in, and this is not Alabama. But it's not Berkeley or the Northeast either. It's Illinois, and it's uniquely, I think, in the middle, and I think there is a lane there for that centrist type of approach going forward.
Pat, how do you do that? We just have about a minute left, so if you could answer. I know this is a tough question to answer quickly, but when we have national conversations, I'm thinking about the national GOP and Iowa Representative Stephen King and the things he's saying about, like, white supremacy. I mean, those are the things that are kind of, I think, grabbing a lot of headlines when you have national forces that maybe are even more pushing to the edges. How do you weigh that in Illinois?
Well, I'll call Stephen King for what he is. He's an idiot. He's been an idiot for a long time. And I know he got his committee positions, but he should be censured and never reelected. Those comments were way out of bounds. But there are some national headwinds we're working against in suburban and Cook and the Collars. President Trump is tremendously unpopular in those areas. I walked precincts for both our congressional candidates that lost, and the president is very unpopular. We've got to deal with that as a party, because our image right now is not very good given some of the things he's done and some of the things we've seen from some others in the party.
That's former Illinois GOP Chair Pat Brady. Pat, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it. I want to thank Ted McClellan for being with us as well. We'll tweet out Ted's story. Gentlemen, both of you, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Some 800,000 federal workers are on furlough on this day, 25 of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Even though the entire government hasn't shut down, many agencies have been affected. And when you think of organizations like the USDA, 96% of that staff has been furloughed. That's affected not just farmers, but various food programs in different ways. Our records show that for a few years ago that in Illinois, there are about 1.8 million people who receive assistance from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's commonly known as SNAP. Sometimes people call it food stamps, those benefits. Thanks to a workaround, those folks are going to get funding for another month, but it requires that those benefits be distributed by January 20th. It's a shorter and faster window than normal. We wanted to know how this will affect not just recipients, but the retailers that they visit. Alexia Alejalde Ruiz has been reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune. She's on the line from the newsroom there. In studio with me is Craig Gunderson, a professor in the College of Agriculture and Consumer Economics. That's what he teaches at the U of I. Alexia, Craig, both of you, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alexia, I wonder if you can just first tell us a little bit about how this provision works, how SNAP is able to continue, even though Congress has technically only approved funding through January.
Yeah, so there's a kind of obscure provision in the budget bill that allows some agencies to fund programs for additional 30 days after the last budget bill expired December 21st. And so the USDA employed that in order to fund SNAP for February benefits for SNAP. But as part of that, they have to disperse those benefits by January 20th.
Craig, how does it normally work when we're thinking about disbursements? Does it normally happen once a month?
Right. Generally, the way SNAP works is that people receive benefits once a month at varying, depending upon the state, on varying days throughout the month.
Okay. And so, Craig, before it was announced that people would get their February benefits, was there a lot of fear that people might not get benefits in February?
Well, fortunately, is that as SNAP is an extraordinarily successful program, let me first say that. And one of the reasons it's been successful is that it's an entitlement program whereby benefits can increase as needed whenever there's more demand for benefits. And also as part of an entitlement program, even when the government shuts down, is they still have the benefits coming forward. So that's critically important to these households.
Okay. And so, Alexia, I wonder when we're thinking about this, do people know that this is happening, that they're going to get benefits on January 20th?
So that's the big challenge, is that people, first of all, the people know that there's a shutdown. People know that could be a potential threat to their benefits, and that has been concerning a lot of recipients. And so some retailers are saying that customers are shopping less frequently, you know, in order to kind of save them up. So when the USDA announced last week that February benefits would be covered, that they would be available, a lot, you know, getting that information to people generally was a big challenge. And even a bigger challenge was telling them that the benefits would be coming earlier than usual, a couple weeks earlier than usual. The concern there being that people might not realize that those benefits hitting their link cards by January 20th has to last them through February.
Go ahead, Craig.
Right. So I was going to say is that low-income households in the United States are enormously resourceful and also enormous. I mean, they face incredible challenges. It's hard being poor in our country. And so when they do get this, I'm quite sure that they're most all of them are very aware of the government shutdown and how this will impact their ability to receive SNAP. And given that, they will be receiving money at an earlier time period than they did before. But I think that they will recognize this and appropriately smooth their consumption in response to this.
Craig, I want to go back to something you said before, which is something you said on the show in the past, but I'm hoping you can explain again, which is that SNAP is a very successful program. And what do you mean by that?
So the central goal of SNAP in our country is to alleviate food insecurity and hunger. And study after study after study has shown that it's been extraordinarily successful in achieving this goal. If it wasn't for SNAP in our country, we'd have literally millions more people who are suffering from hunger. And this is why it's so really critical that SNAP benefits continue despite the government shutdown.
And when we're thinking about the typical SNAP recipient, is there a demographic that we could think of in terms of who's a typical SNAP recipient? Or when we're thinking about age, I know we often talk about children and the elderly in terms of benefiting from this.
So one of the strengths of SNAP is that it's the only food assistance program we have that's available to people across the lifespan. So everything from infants up to centenarians are able to receive benefits through through SNAP. The most common recipient of SNAP is a child in a household.
Mm-hmm. Alexia, you mentioned retailers. I wonder what you're hearing from retailers in Illinois from your reporting about the fact that you said, first of all, I want to clarify something that you said. First of all, are you saying that retailers are saying that they feel people are not spending as much of their benefit? They've been saving it because they're worried it's going to run out?
Yeah, some owners of corner stores I talked to said that, you know, when people were just kind of concerned about the fate of their benefits, they were shopping a little bit less just to preserve their benefits. But then conversely, when the benefits hit their accounts a little earlier than usual, then the concern is that they might spend right away, not realizing that these are their February benefits that have to last them through the end of the month. So initially there was the concern that people just didn't know what was going to happen, which was causing a lot of anxiety. And now there's concern that people might not realize that these benefits that come through are, again, kind of like a ahead of schedule disbursement as a result of this weird, you know, workaround for the shutdown. But the retailer associations are making it a priority to notify their members, you know, what's happening and asking them to educate consumers about the change so that people just know what's going on so they know to budget appropriately. And they're also urging the retailers to stock up because there could be just, you know, a lot of people shopping the long weekend of January 20th, which is also MLK weekend, as people, you know, get their benefits and go grocery shopping. So it's just a question of staffing up and stocking up to be prepared.
So I just wanted to add one thing to that, is that just the vast majority of SNAP benefits are spent at large-scale supermarkets. About 85% of those are spent there. Another 10% are spent at supermarkets. Really, these corner stores, while an important component of where people shop using their SNAP benefits, is it's a relatively small proportion of overall SNAP benefits. And generally, those individuals who do have to go to the corner shop might need a gallon of milk. But when we think about their major purchases, is it's done at, you know, the Myers, the Walmarts, the Jewel Osco, some of these larger stores where people are going to purchase things. And I think that those stores would be able to handle that more people will be coming in. But again, is that poor households in the United States are very astute at managing on a limited budget.
When you have a limited budget, you're really paying attention to how much you're spending.
Right. If you or I go without money for a little bit, I think that, we'll both be fine. But if you're low income, you have to be watching every dollar. So they're very aware that, you know, how to manage the money in these very difficult situations.
But what about the message for this? As we're talking about this, that's Craig Gunderson, who teaches agriculture and consumer economics at the University of Illinois. Alexia Alejalde Ruiz is also with us. She's been reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune. Alexia, I wanted to ask you, if most of the USDA is shut down, so how is if you mentioned that some retailers are trying to get messaging out as well, if people are concerned about this message getting out there, because the federal government is mostly shut down, is the federal government telling people about this, or whose responsibility is it at this point?
Right. So the state of Illinois, the Department of Human Services, is the agency for Illinois, at least, that administers the program. And they held a press conference last week, kind of really like saying that they were relying on the media to get the message out to people, as well as food banks, as well as kind of community partners and retailers to get the message out. Because like you said, the USDA is shut down. Very few people are working. So they're not communicating directly with with SNAP recipients. And the state agency, the Illinois Department of Human Services, says that they can't rely on their usual ways of communicating with people, which is to send mailings, just because this is such short notice that they don't have time to do that. So they were concerned about just the information getting out there. So they're putting on their social media feeds, on their website, and stuff like that. So yeah, so it's fallen to the state agencies, the retailers, and to community partners to get the word out.
And so, Alexia, is it a question about March? Do we know what's going to happen next?
No, I think that's the big concern, is that this February fix was a temporary one, and it's not clear what will happen in March. There's a $3 billion reserve fund available, but that's still less than the monthly cost of the program, and it's not clear if that will be used to help out in March.
How is the shutdown affecting other federal food programs, Alexia?
Well, another thing that's happening is that there are retailers who got caught in this weird limbo just before the shutdown. They were supposed to get their SNAP license reauthorized and let it lapse for one reason or another. And usually, you know, there's a team at USDA that fields those calls to get their licenses reinstated, but that's shut down right now. So there's about 2,500 retailers across the country that have lapsed licenses, which can be pretty devastating to retailers that rely heavily on SNAP for business. So that's happening. Also, new SNAP licenses are not being issued during the shutdown. So new store openings that would like to open with SNAP can't do so. And then there's the question of food banks and food pantries. You know, there's concern that obviously as furloughed federal workers go without paychecks, that they themselves might face food insecurity. And so food banks are, you know, preparing for that possibility that these workers will then seek help.
Craig, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, as we think of how many federal workers, how many paychecks now federal workers really are starting to miss. We're 25 days into this, so now people are missing paychecks. I wonder how much furloughs can affect things, as Alexia's talking about, the whole issue of being able to pay for your groceries, being able to pay for utility bills, those sorts of things.
So in the food insecurity research, as it's been shown consistently, that unexpected income shocks can have a huge impact. And I think that for a lot of federal workers, this was an unexpected shock. They didn't expect to not be paid over this time period. So especially for those at the lower levels of pay within the federal government, they may face some serious challenges because they may not have savings to buttress this or access to other credit. One group that I really want to emphasize that's often been overlooked in all this are contract workers. In other words, you have a lot of very low-paid workers who are cleaning up contract government workers who are cleaning up federal buildings, who are serving meals in the cafeteria of these federal buildings. They're the ones who are often furloughed, and their incomes already were very low. And so I think that we have to be talking about federal workers, yes, but I think we should be talking a lot more about some of these contract workers who are cleaning up and serving the federal workers at usual times.
Right. And I guess also misconceptions people have. People think, oh, if you're a federal worker, you have a good salary, you should have a cushion to go through the shutdown. Craig, you're saying you don't think that's the case at all for some people.
For a lot of contract workers, it's definitely not the case that, I mean, some contract workers are paid well, but most are serving as janitorial staff and cafeteria workers. There's also a lot of people that, doing secretarial work and other work within the federal government, they really do not make a lot of money. And I think that they will face some serious challenges, especially since this was unexpected. I mean, there's been when I used to work for the government, I was there when there was shutdowns, but they only lasted a short time period. This one's lasting longer.
Right. And unfortunately, there's no end in sight at this point as well. That's Craig Gunderson. He is in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics. We appreciate your perspective and information and insight on the SNAP program. I want to thank Alexia Elahalde Ruiz for being with us as well, a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. We'll tweet out Alexia's stories so you can see that. Alexia, Craig, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows if you download it, and then you can set your home station, whatever your local NPR station is. And if you search for The 21st to follow us, that's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When you're not on air, when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We've got lots of pictures from yesterday's inauguration up on Twitter or on our Facebook page as well. If you search for The 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on, post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or if you don't remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. And I'm Ella Boudou. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.